Broadcasting from Morton College Radio in Cicero, Illinois, this is Liquid Sound. This first ever episode of Liquid Sound will be dedicated in its entirety to an interview with writer Stuart Dybek. My guest today on Liquid Sound is Stuart Dybek. He's the author of multiple books, including the collections of poetry, Brass Knuckles, and Streets in Their Own Ink, and the short story collections Childhood and Other Neighborhoods, The Coast of Chicago, and I Sailed with Magellan. His literary awards include the Lannan Prize, a Penn Malamud Award, a Whiting Writers Award, a Guggenheim, and several O. Henry Prizes. His work has been anthologized in the Best American Short Stories and Best American Poetry anthologies. He's a Rea Award winner, a MacArthur Fellow, and a professor of writing at Northwestern University. I am very pleased to welcome and very, very happy to speak to Mr. Stuart Dybek.
Thank you.
How are you doing?
Good.
The first thing I'd like to talk to you about, I'd like to take you back to about a 30-hour period of your life. September 25th, 2007 to September 26th, 2007. I'm sure those dates ring a bell.
I think they do.
Yeah. What was it like to experience that 30-hour period? And can you explain it to us in detail?
Well, I'm afraid it's going to sound a little anticlimactic. It was maybe more cliched, mm-hmm. in that I was totally surprised. Mm-hmm. And
just to explain to the audience.
Oh, all right. What happened was I got a phone call from the MacArthur Foundation. Mm-hmm. The guy who called me was acquaintance named Jack Fuller. I had many, many zillion years ago reviewed his book, a novel he had written before he became the editor of the Chicago Tribune, and Jack called. I hadn't heard from him in years, 7 a.m. And he said, I have something important to tell you. And I immediately began thinking about what mutual friends we had, who he was going to tell me had just bit the dust. And he could hear the alarm in my voice and said, no, it's a good thing. The MacArthur Foundation is so secretive that I don't think anybody ever has a hint that an award is coming. So, but I was, speaking of secrecy, I was sworn to secrecy because they let you know before it's released to the press, but they tell you not to tell anyone. Mm-hmm. And so I was having breakfast in that 30-hour period when I got another call, and this time it was from the foundation that Michael Ray started, and his widow told me I'd won the award, and I wasn't able to tell her that I had. So I'm sure that my natural, you know, I'm a babbler by nature, but I think my babbling reached new heights, new depths.
Mm-hmm. So you were forced, just by circumstance, to babble about something that you couldn't babble about.
Yeah. Actually, when I finally was able to tell her that I also had just won a MacArthur, she said, well, that's absolutely wonderful. Mm-hmm. Because it'll draw attention to the Ray Award that a lot of people really don't know what it is.
And that's exactly it. I did not know what it was until I realized that there was this synchronicity. And this is from a person who's spent his life studying literature, you know. Now, so here it is. So you receive these two prestigious awards within a 30-hour period. And after that, at some point, I'm assuming you had to sit down to write again, right?
Well, I was writing at the time, which I was grateful for because I had promised a wonderful editor over at the Washington Post, who was fighting the good fight to keep fiction, mm-hmm. in the paper, a story. But after I met my deadline with that piece, which I was well into, there were so many interviews and things that I suspect that anybody who gets that award, in fact, I think the award says that one of the things it wants to do is attract attention to the work of the recipients. And, you know, so many of them are doing these amazing kinds of science and humanitarian stuff that it just, wonderful that attention is attracted. But part of that attention attraction means that you're doing a lot of interviews. Mm-hmm. And in a way,
it's a distraction from your own.
Well, it is, but, you know, I mean, it seems so... It's such a minor price to pay for,
yeah,
and like all things, it goes away. So,
mm-hmm. Well, this is what I'm interested in, the it goes away, because prior to winning those awards, I mean, it wasn't like you were an unaccomplished writer prior to that. You have, you know, all these from the introduction. There's quite a bit of success here, but somewhere along the line, it must have occurred to you that, all right, I'm not just some guy who's trying to write stories anymore. Now I'm Stuart Dybeck, and I've won these awards. Did that affect or change the way you approached your work?
I certainly tried not to let it. You know, I think that the fact that I got it late in a career meant that I had already made what accommodations I was going to make, that everybody has to in one way or another, so far as believing what you hear. You know, I mean, I've always used a kind of a standard that if you believe the praise, you kind of have obligated yourself to believe the criticism. Mm-hmm. But it isn't even so outward aimed as that. It's inward aimed. Mm-hmm. That is that part of writing for a lot of writers from conversation, I certainly know for myself, is it's a kind of a bipolar activity. That is, some days you think that you've written the most spectacular thing, and then a couple of days later, just to read a word that you've written, it's also disappointing. And after a while, you just kind of learn to ignore that. Mm-hmm. and try to find some... It doesn't mean that you still don't experience the bounce of those feelings. It just means that you found some way. I think one reason, I'm not finishing my sentences. But I think one reason that sports like boxing have so fascinated writers, besides the obvious thing that writing loves conflict, is that there's something about that athletics that makes you put yourself on... ignore those rises and falls. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's the first time you, as an American male, that you notice that. Mm-hmm. is in sports rather than in writing. Anyway, what I think occurs, or at least has occurred for me, is that because I've had to make my adjustments towards my own rises and falls of feelings, mm-hmm. that's operative towards... what goes on in a career.
And so really the announcement of these awards was just yet another thing for you to have to learn to move to the side and disengage in a way in order to be able to do your own work.
Yeah. I mean one of the page is still blank. What we're calling a page now is basically a screen.
Or screen, sure.
The screen is still blank and you still have to put something up there. Mm-hmm. And you can get all the awards in the world and it might change your access to publication. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it in any way can make you a better writer. It can make you a better writer in giving you money so that you can buy time for yourself. But, you know, it's one of those things like money can't buy a 90-mile-an-hour fastball. Well, these days it needs to be 97-mile-an-hour sure. fastball or, you know, that kind of a thing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So the opposite then wasn't true. It wasn't that you suddenly felt an enormous amount of pressure to deliver a product in the aftermath of these enormous accolades that you didn't feel before and then and that also became interference of a sort.
You know, if the pressure is there, it's coming it's coming from inside. Mm. And I think writing well, I mean, you know, writing, nobody really cares if you write or not. And so you're going to have to be one of, it's almost mandatory that the pressure to write is going to come from inside, at least fiction. You know, you might contract for a nonfiction project, but very seldom do people contract for a fiction project. And so if you're going to write, that it's going to be start with the self with self-pressure anyway. So,
and the perception that perhaps now I have a new audience who showed up because I've gotten this attention, that fits into the same category, that even if you believe that or if it's actually real, a bigger audience has shown up and they're going to judge me in a new way, you still have to perceive yourself the way you perceived yourself when you were writing the things that led to those awards.
I guess. You know, I mean, I have to tell you, frankly, I don't think anybody can quite escape all the things you're saying. I mean, they're obvious to oneself. Mm-hmm. But they're kind of background static for me, mm-hmm. at most. I mean, I don't think of writing in terms of self. I think of it in terms of the object I'm trying to make. So, you know, I'm writing a story right now called Tosca, and after the opera.
After the opera.
And really, all I think about, is, you know, in other words, I don't think about is Stuart Dybbuk writing a story that if people read, they'll say, Jesus, this guy got a MacArthur, and this is what they give MacArthur. Yeah. You know, I just don't think that way. I mean, I think, oh, man, how much of that great aria that Caravadossi sings do I need to put in? And mm-hmm. you know, I mean, just those little, you're so obsessed with those little questions of making something. And the thing is that you want to climb into that world. Mm-hmm. And when you climb into that world right, the wonderful thing is you disappear. Mm-hmm. And so that's what you're always after. You're always after that becoming so involved in the piece you're working on that you disappear. And that sense of wanting to disappear is in some way an antidote to that sense of wanting to think about your place in the world all the time, you know, and it's...
Yeah.
So...
I'd like to get deeper into that moment with you. Take us through your typical writing routine, and not just, you know, what time of day you write or something like that, but what goes through your mind when, you know, let's say you're in the kitchen doing whatever it is, you're making a cup of coffee, and then that's it, you're done with that, you bring it to the screen, and now you're writing. What happens in your mind when you start doing it?
Well, I'm not. Writing is a kind of thinking, but it's not for me, it's not intellectualizing. And until I really have a piece well along in draft, I'm listening to music. And it's the kind of music that if you played it at a party, everybody would get up and leave.
Or jump out the window or something.
Well, they wouldn't jump out the window. They'd get out and leave so they didn't fall asleep.
Ah, okay.
Because it's hypnotic and repetitive and probably minimalist. We were... And And so one of the reasons I'm listening to that music is I'm looking to be taken out of the mind that thinks and to be put into the mind that thinks syllogistically. Mm-hmm. If X equals Y and Y equals Z, X equals Z. Or the mind that thinks Aristotelianly. Mm-hmm. That is that trees have leaves and this thing has leaves. It must be a tree. You know, the kind of thinking that goes on in writing is closer to the kind of thinking that goes on in music or any of the fine arts. Mm-hmm. It's just that it's happening with language. So I'm thinking about images, or I'm thinking about credibility is something I think a lot about. Why would a character do this? Mm-hmm. And that usually helps me invent. I'm a very mood based writer, so I'm thinking about staying in that mood. Mm-hmm. and seeing where it takes me. And the other thing is I usually don't know where the story or the poem, where they're going. Mm-hmm. With the exception of if it's based heavily on autobiography. Mm-hmm. A lot of times I don't even know where I want to get. Mm-hmm. So it's more like kind of feeling my way in the dark, waiting for an accident, putting layers. Going, I rewrite an awful lot, and so I'll go back over the next day's work to get a running start, but also looking for clues that I didn't see that particular day, and you know, so it's that kind of a process.
Now, in my opinion, your writing's quite visual. Mm-hmm. Right, it's almost cinematic, but in this visceral cinema, you know, this three-dimensional cinema that also has sense and wind and such. I'm thinking particularly of a short inner chapter piece from the coast of Chicago called Farwell, which is mm-hmm. one of my favorite pieces of writing period that I've ever read.
No, thank you.
And it's so visual that when I'm thinking about, well, how does he do it? How does he sit there? And what goes through his mind? Do you actually see all of that stuff in your mind? Or is it small little pieces that you discover word by word?
Well, it's a really interesting question. I don't really know. I can only know in retrospect, because to know at the moment would ruin the moment. Mm-hmm. The self-reflexiveness would take me away from what I'm trying to do. But what the classroom word for that is realize something. What I'm always, I don't think with that word, armed with that word, but for conversation's sake, mm-hmm. what I'm always trying to do is realize something more deeply and find those little fresh, try to find some fresh way of seeing something that the reader can attach to. You know, I'll give you a for instance. I looked at this piece earlier today. It's a piece I wrote maybe about a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. It's set in Pilsen on Christmas Eve, big Slavic holiday.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And in the piece, it's told mostly from the point of view of the child, me. It's actually, the kid's name is mine. It's mm-hmm. it's a nonfiction chapter in a nonfiction novel. It appeared in The Atlantic in July's issue. It's called Vigil, after the Polish name for Christmas Eve, which is Vigilia. And it's the vigil of the shepherds. Mm-hmm. And before the interview started, I was talking a little bit about Lithuanian girlfriends. So mm-hmm. I had a Lithuanian girlfriend at Loyola. Uh-huh. And she makes it into this piece, because the piece, even though it's set with a child who hasn't made his first Holy Communion yet, it flashes forward a few times. Mm-hmm. This is a long roundabout way to get to a little point. In one of the flash forwards, the kid is trying to tell the, is part of the story, how if you grow up in an immigrant household, how important food is. Mm-hmm. Not just because the ethnic cuisine conveys culture, but because these are all people who came on the lam, so to speak.
Yeah.
And they, a lot of times they didn't know where that next meal was coming from. So the guy in the story, me, is on the bank of Loyola's Lakeshore campus. And here's this girlfriend that he hasn't seen all summer. And the story doesn't explain what happened. It just says that she was angry and there had been broken promises. Mm-hmm. And she throws her lunch. Her mother still packs her lunch. She throws her sandwich into the lake. And the guy says, this is worse for immigrants than breaking into tears.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at it today. It's in a magazine. Mm-hmm. When it gets in a book, I'll rewrite some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And it talks about her rye bread sandwich. Number one is it doesn't mention it's rye bread. Mm-hmm. It should mention it's rye bread. Mm-hmm. So I'll change that. Mm-hmm. So to change it to rye bread is gonna help quote realize it more deeply.
Yeah.
But it's floating on top of the water, mm-hmm. because it's quote slathered with butter. Mm-hmm. Now that's true, in at least in immigrant households I know, you slather it with something, yeah. Mayonnaise, yeah. Butter, pork Miracle Whip, fat. Pork fat, lard, whatever. Yeah. You know, maybe all those things. So, you know, when I wrote it, no matter how many drafts I did before the Atlantic took it, it never occurred to me to put, which is why it was floating. Mm-hmm. But in my mind, if I put that in there, it's going to help the reader see it in the watermark.
It will, and it answers my question about the visuals.
But let me go on one step further. I've used the verb slathered. Mm-hmm. It's a good verb. Mm-hmm. But it's a cliched verb for when you want to put a lot of stuff on a sandwich. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, it's taken the reader to that good mid-brow cliche. Mm-hmm. So the reader can now see bread slathered with butter floating. Mm-hmm. Now, I might not be able to do it, but something says to me, can you find, okay, slathered, there's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. It's not like saying the snow was a blanket of white or the leaves scarlet and gold. It's not that bad. Mm-hmm. But it's like a reflex. There's a reflex there. Uh-huh. Can I get past that reflex? Maybe you can't. Sometimes you just can't find a better word, what mm-hmm. the French call the mot juste, the mm-hmm. perfect word. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's just like such one such little aspect of using the medium of language, where you're trying always to turn language into some kind of fresh experience for the reader.
I don't consider that small. I mean, that's what it's about. It's about looking at the world one word at a time, in a way. I mean, so you're simultaneously doing both. You're imagining the lake, and you're seeing it and doing all these things. But then later on, the word slathered becomes this topic that needs to be dealt with. It anticipates my next question in a very interesting way. I've heard you speak on numerous occasions at conferences and at the Chicago Public Library. I've also heard you read. And very often when audience members ask you questions about, well, how did you do this or how did something happen? You talk about writing in terms of targets, in terms of the target that the author's trying to get to, and then what happens when you miss. To contextualize it for the audience, at the AWP conference, somebody asked you about nostalgia in various stories that you had written about Pilsen. And you told a story about a bridge that had been, in your artistic, you haunted by the history of Pilsen. And you said the target for the author should be to haunt the story. And when the author fails to haunt the story, he achieves nostalgia. And that's a lesser target or a worse situation than actually haunting. I'm wondering, when did you formulate that way of explaining a story in this semi-technical way, but also in this really artistic way?
You mean using the idea of the target? I think that is something that's come out of teaching rather than, mm-hmm. In other words, that when you teach, you're forced to articulate things that you wouldn't not have had to articulate to yourself. It doesn't mean you wouldn't have recognized them. Mm-hmm. It just, but there's a difference between articulating something. Mm-hmm. And in the classroom, trying to accelerate the writing process for the young writers in the room. And the first, if memory is correct, and it well might not be, what I remember when that word first entered my thinking was, I was trying to explain something about closure. And I told this little anecdote that I always keep meaning to write up and then I don't, about when I was a student, maybe 18, and I'd heard, at that point I knew a lot of these great names, but I never read anything by any of them. Hemingway, Chekhov, I mean, I'd heard of them. And here was, that first introduction to the modern literature class, and you get a little anthology. And The Dead, I remember reading The Dead in that anthology, Joyce. Mm-hmm. And my general feeling, to be honest at that point, was almost disappointment, story by story. I don't know what I was expecting, mm-hmm. but it wasn't what I was getting. It was just immaturity. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was part of being educated. The Dead disappointed me terribly because I thought it was going to be spooky.
Uh-huh. You thought there'd be actually someone dying.
Yeah, well, and it was all, zombies or, not that bad. But. And, I'd probably gone on to read that story about 15 times since, but the first time through, I thought, man, it's talky. Mm-hmm. And it's about adults.
And there are so many people in it.
A lot of people, I thought it was going to be Poe-like, mm-hmm. who I loved Poe growing up, So, Chekhov, the story there was, I think, called Grief. And very briefly, it's a story about a guy, a little carriage driver, a taxi cab driver, but he's driving a horse mm-hmm. and buggy in the middle of a Moscow winter. And so he's exposed to the elements, and he picks up a general or somebody and tries to say something, and the general talks over him and tells him how great he is. And he picks up a woman from the opera all dressed in ermine, and same thing happens maybe three times, like in jokes, we need three times. Everybody he picks up is of a higher class, and they all are full of their own gripes and jealousies and envies, and he keeps trying to tell a story. And finally, about 4 a.m, when his carriage driving has no more people waiting, he takes the bridle off his little horse, and he tells his little horse that his son or daughter, I don't remember now, has just died of God knows what, diphtheria, whatever was mm-hmm. killing kids in those days. And, I read this story. It seemed sentimental to me. It didn't even seem like a story.
It seemed empty.
No, not empty. I just didn't, what's the big deal about this? And it was only 20 years later, at least, and I was standing in an Osco when they still sold fishing gear. And I was going to go visit a friend in St. Lucia, and I knew we would be fishing, and I thought I'd bring some gear. So I was buying the biggest silver spoon they had, probably for salmon fishermen. But I was going to use it for jacks and things. And an old man came up, and he says, "Man, what are you going to catch with that?" He says, "You know, that's bigger than the fish I catch." I said, "Oh, I'm not going to fish around here." He said, "Where do you fish around here with that?" I said, "Well, not around here. I'm going to go to St. Lucia." "Well, where's that?" "It's in the Caribbean." "Oh, man," he says. And how are you going to get there? "You're going to fly, aren't you?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Oh, brother. Oh, man. Well, good luck, buddy. Good luck. I hope you make it." I said, "Well, I don't think there's any problem." He says, "Oh, no, a lot of people don't think there's any problem." But he said, "Let me tell you, you have a kid. You protect her from everything. She's president of her class. You set curfews for her dates. You meet all her boyfriends. Everything you do, you protect that girl. And then..." He said, "Let me show you." He takes out his wallet. It's this big, huge, thick one of these accordion things. And he takes the accordion out, and it's all full of exactly what he's talking about. From infant through grade school, through high school, prom night, everything there, you know, picture by picture. And I'm just standing there, so as not to be rude, looking at this garrulous old man's photographs of his daughter. And then he says, "And then you get a call. She's gone. Plane went down. Nothing you can do about it. She's gone." And he suddenly looked at me with such fury, such hatred for me. I mean, I was just, you know, I was, for a second, I thought, I had no idea what I had done. And he slammed the stuff back in his wallet, shoved it in his pocket, whirled on his heel, and marched off. And I just stood there, just dumbfounded, holding my lure. And I suddenly thought of the Chekhov story. And I realized just how deeply immature and unempathetic I was. And that what Chekhov was trying to tell me was that it won't go away. It makes you go to strangers. I mean, I probably was the fifth, you know, what he was angry at was, "God damn it, I've done it again. I've picked out a perfectly innocent, total stranger in an Osco. And I told him all this and I showed him all this." And, you know, directed the hatred toward me, but it was... And I suddenly understood that, I mean, that story opened up. And at that point, an academic idea, a story that can end with a realization. Yeah. I don't think I ever understood. I mean, by then I could tell you all about realization, blah, blah. But until that moment, I don't think I understood it. And it was when I understood it that I realized that if you can change the target of a story from good wins and evil loses, mm-hmm. which was the target of the tale, if you who are sitting there could find some other target for a story, you would be Chekhov. Mm-hmm. You would be Joyce. Mm-hmm. That's what these two guys did.
You are listening to Liquid Sound from Wharton College Radio. We'll be back with more from Stuart Dybek after these public service announcements.